You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jamie and Jason. This is episode 223, and today, Jamie, we're going to be talking about how can we treasure Christ more? And this is a subject that obviously every Christian should be thinking about more. I think it's one that, if anything, the reason we don't think about it more is because we simply don't think about treasuring Christ in concrete ways. It sounds often when we hear encouragements from pastors or in books that we need to treasure Christ, it sounds almost theoretical or almost like this is a great idea. You know, that's especially great for those really serious Christians. But we don't think this is something that is of great practical value. And to be fair, like, we don't want to look at something and say, is this valuable based on how practical it is? What matters ultimately is, does God command this? Does God create us for this? And that should be the first thing on our mind. But treasuring Christ, Jamie, when I think of treasuring Christ, I just think about the fact that you have guys like the Apostle Paul, for instance, who has lived this very zealous religious life. He's done what ought to be done of a good person in every respect. Like he says, as to the law, blameless in Philippians 3. But then when he's like laying side by side that all his religious credentials, all that he's done for Christ, well, all that he's done, I should say, in his mind for God, because that's how he was looking at it, he looks at all of that and he says, that is all for loss, or I consider that all scubalon, which literally means dung, like animal dung. He looks at all the good he did in his Pharisaical, religious, zealous, law-keeping life, and he says, that's all dung. And then he says, and I consider it loss compared to the surpassing worth of knowing Christ. And you just think about how awesome that perspective is, like to be able to say, in no way does my religious credentials, does my paltry righteousness when compared to the righteousness of Christ, in no way does my old life compare with pursuing Christ. And he says, this is his words, he says, I count it all as rubbish in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ, the righteousness from God that depends on faith, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and may share his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, that by any means possible, I may attain the resurrection from the dead. And so in Paul's perspective, nothing, literally nothing, compares to knowing Christ. And I think one of the things we want to focus on maybe in this conversation is knowing Christ is not merely knowing facts about Jesus or knowing even knowing the truth of the gospel, because I have atheist friends who know the facts of the gospel. They can tell you, they can literally tell you what God has done and how to be saved, right? But what they can't do in their rebellion and in their hatred of God and in their denial of God's existence is they can't tell you how much they treasure Christ. And so there's this massive difference between knowing about Jesus, knowing what is expected of Christians even, and knowing Christ himself, knowing his person, knowing his the beauty of his worth, the preciousness of who he is, and just pursuing him, living a life that is in pursuit of Christ and valuing him above everything else. Because this is about what God asks of us. He doesn't just want external conformity to a set of regulations. He wants our hearts. And the fact that, you know, we have Paul saying things like, if anyone does not love Jesus, let him be accursed, right? Like, why would he say, if anyone doesn't love Jesus? Isn't it enough, Paul, to say, if anyone doesn't trust in Jesus for salvation, let him be anathema? But no, Paul says, if anyone doesn't love Jesus, see, that's why regeneration is such an important topic, and we've touched on it many times in this podcast, because having a heart that longs for more of Jesus is not something that comes about through mere law-keeping or mere seeking to be a better version of yourself. It's a life pursuing Jesus himself and letting our love for him and his love for us transform who we are, so that it's not a pursuit of good standing with God, because that's already been won for us through the cross and resurrection. It's a pursuit of knowing Jesus more and more and loving him more and more because he's given us this good standing. And as Paul says, this righteousness that is not my own. So as I kind of bring up this subject and look at some of the things that we're thinking about here, what comes to mind for you, Jamie?
Well, I would say first, you know, it isn't even in relationship to the gospel as well. It isn't even just, do I understand it? Can I articulate it? But do I actually really understand what God has done for me? Because that's something I think that Christians very often don't actually understand is, you know, we've kind of bought into the more sanitized version of the gospel, which is, you know, oh, God loves and Jesus died and we, you know, whatever. And it's kind of a gospel of propitiation, not a gospel of genuine process, which is to say that not only did God restore us in relationship with him through the Son, but God also dealt with the full wrath over sin. And then it actually goes even further back than that, which is to say that God had to move for us to be saved. And that's something, you know, I think we so much don't want to accept as humans, that our salvation at every step is 100% the work of God and 0% us. It wasn't we chose God, it was God chose us, right? It wasn't that we sought out God, it was that God sought out us. It wasn't that we made ourselves alive, it was God awakened us from the dead. You know, because you think about it, the biblical picture of us, like John 3:19, that we were desperately in sin. And not only that, but we loved our evil. I mean, we were evil and we loved it. And we wanted no part of the truth. We wanted no part of the light at all. That is the condition of humans. So the story of the gospel is actually starts with, we rebelled against God. We decided we don't want to follow you. We don't want you to be God. I want to be God, right? Very much the rebellion of our own heart matches the rebellion of Satan and the angels that followed him, which was, I want to be God. And the result of that is we became dead to sin. Ephesians 2, for example, right? You were dead in sin. We had no ability then to come to God. We had no ability to be redeemed. We had no ability to be to be saved or sanctified or restored or anything. And when you understand that, all of a sudden, the gospel becomes dramatically more meaningful and dramatically more serious and dramatically more impactful and dramatically more valuable. And so when you look at the work of Christ on the cross, it becomes something even more amazing, right, than just this kind of basic sanitized version, which was literally God called us, God redeemed us, God dealt with the full wrath of our sin, the full cost of our sin. All of that was visited on the Son, and then we were able to be restored in relationship to God. And so it's kind of that, you know, what are the things, Jason, that you value the most? Well, they're the things that you had to work or that cost the most, right? That required the most, that took the most effort, that, you know, that's the stuff you require, or that's the stuff you really treasure, right? You treasure your wife. Why? Well, it was probably harder to get your wife than it was to get the TV in your living room, right? And so the value comes from how I understand what's actually taken place, or what actually was involved, or what actually this thing means. And so to that end, I think we do begin with the gospel, because when we have a proper biblical understanding of that, then how could I not treasure Christ, right? The way the author of Hebrews put it in Hebrews chapter 12 is, fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who did what? For the joy that lay before him, endured the cross, despised the shame, right? Like Jesus took a lot to be able to provide that propitiation for us. And when I understand that, now I treasure it so much more, because I actually see what Christ has really done for me.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's worth thinking through. I remember reading about how one of the, I think it was maybe John Owen was, either John Owen or Thomas Goodwin, I'm not remembering, but one of the Puritans said, let's suppose that God is not the one who came up with the plan of redemption. Do you believe that sinful men and women, or even the angels, would ever come up with the plan of redemption, that we would be saved in this way? And the answer is no, we never could, because that's simply beyond our wisdom. It's beyond our thinking that God could become a man. In other words, we couldn't rationalize ourselves, or we couldn't rationally come to the gospel just through our own human means. We couldn't come up with that whole idea of God becoming a man, and then not only becoming one of us, but then suffering the just wrath of God in our place. As you said it, Jamie, it's beyond full comprehension even. We can understand what happened based on what we're taught in the gospel, but we can't fully grasp everything that happened because it's too wonderful. It's simply too incredible, and it's something that we never could have imagined on our own. And I think once you start there and you realize God actually created, knowing there was going to be a fall, he knew, you know, it didn't catch him off guard, obviously, when Adam and Eve sinned in the garden. He knew from eternity that this would happen. And so he knew from eternity that there would be the God-man, that Jesus, who is eternally the Son of God, would become a man and purchase our redemption. And I think this is something that just, you know, it boggles the mind when you think about, like, God had it in his plan that this would be so, that this whole mass of the human race would become rebellious against him, and that he would send his own son Jesus to redeem sinners. That is I mean, it's just astounding to think of the Father's plan from the beginning. And yet, because we're often very me-centered in our thinking, we even do theology this way, where we think, oh, what does this do for me, or how does this relate to me? And the Bible reminds us that you need to take the lens back farther, because it's actually all for God's glory, ultimately. And in Colossians 1, you have this phenomenal statement that Jesus is the image of the invisible God. He is the visible representation, the visible, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. So whatever your view of Jesus has been, if you have seen him as any less than the creator of all things, that he made everything that you value in life, he made every molecule that is in existence, it came from him and through him. And then he says, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. So all of creation not only owes its existence to Jesus, but was created for Jesus. It's for his glory that everything exists. And so you think about all the statements in Scripture that talk about, you know, living for the glory of God, and the fact that, you know, even Adam is in places like 1 Corinthians 15 and Hebrews 2, he's basically seen as like the representative man, right? And we were all in Adam. We all belong to Adam in the sense of our sin, the fact that we were all destined to die in Adam. And this massive change happens in redemption, because no longer are you in Adam or belong to Adam where he's your representative, but now you're in Christ. It is in him and for him that everything exists. And so he's the goal of everything. He is the Lord. And so when he's resurrected, and before he ascends into heaven, he says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. And to think of it as just a, you know, this is a great man, is, if you stop there, you're dishonoring Jesus. If you say Jesus is the most influential figure in history, we owe so much to Jesus, and easily he was the greatest man to ever live. That's dishonoring Jesus if you leave it there. Because Jesus himself said in John chapter 5 that we are to honor him as we honor the Father. In other words, for anyone who would say Jesus is a great prophet, or Jesus is a great teacher, or Jesus shows us the way to God, if you stop there and don't go even farther and say he is equal with God, he is one with the Father, and that we should honor Jesus in the same way we honor the Father, honor God. If we don't understand that he is the goal of everything, then we have dishonored him, and we have actually ultimately rejected him, because we haven't received him as he really is. And I think just having that wide angle perspective on Christ is essential, because we'll never treasure Jesus if we don't know him. If we don't have true and high thoughts of Jesus, if we just have this low view of Jesus, we'll never treasure him. We'll maybe like him, we'll maybe appreciate him, but we won't love him in the way that Paul urges us as believers to do. And I think that, you know, the one of the biggest needs really in the church today is having that high Christology, that high view of Christ, and reiterating this and reminding people of this, so that every time people come through our church doors and hear the word preached, they recognize that this is all about Jesus. That's why this group is gathering. That's why these people are singing. That's why this message is being proclaimed, it's because Jesus is the creator, the sustainer, the redeemer, the Lord of all, and everything is for him. And then people will begin to say, oh, do I treasure Jesus for all those things?
And that is the key, right? If you truly treasured, and if I truly treasured, then it would literally be the most valuable thing to us. And you see that, you know, in examples like Psalm 73, verse 25, whom have I in heaven but you? And the earth has nothing I desire besides you. Right? Or Jesus compares the kingdom of heaven in Matthew chapter 13. He compares it to a man who goes and finds buried treasure, right, in a field. And what does he do? He goes and he sells literally everything he owns and then comes back and buys that land, right? Says the kingdom of heaven is like treasure buried in a field, and the man who found it reburies it. Then in his joy, he goes and sells everything he has and buys the field. Why? Because there's treasure there, right? Makes sense. Totally makes sense. And then he goes on. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of a pearl, in search of fine pearls. When he finds one priceless pearl, he went out, sold everything he had, and bought it. Why? Because it's priceless, right? It's the greatest thing there is. This is the thing that he has been searching for his entire life, right? This is the very quest of the man's life, was to find this priceless pearl. And guess what? He found it. So what does he do? Goes and sells everything for it. Of course you would. And that's the attitude when I really recognize who God is and what God has done. And you see that, the beauty of that, right? In fact, I think of the song, I think it was Stephen Curtis Chapman, early 90s, The Treasure of Jesus, right? If I should sing, let my songs be full of his glory. If I should speak, let all my words be full of his praise. If I should live or die, let me be found pursuing the prize, the one that alone satisfies, the treasure of Jesus. The recognition that there isn't something more satisfying than Christ. That's not a thing, right? That's the very thing that the entire Bible from cover to cover is drawing us to look at, to see, to engage, to understand, to get to enter into this culmination that ultimately comes to manifest in the bride of Christ coming together with the groom, right? In Revelations, where you have this beauty, you have this amazing reality of finally getting to be in the glory of God. And what awe, what amazingness that is. Something that, like, even our human minds and our finite understanding of things can't even grasp. I mean, you know, go back to that example of Moses in Exodus chapter 30. He wants to see the glory of God. And he's like, God, I want to see your glory. And the response is, you can't handle it, right? You can't handle it. He only got to see a little glimpse, and even that little glimpse was too much. He couldn't handle it. This is the idea, right? Recognizing who God is, and when I have that perspective, that's a powerful, life-changing, reorienting way I think and feel and believe and engage and walk and live, all centered around what is truly the actual priceless treasure, and that's Christ.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that stands out to me from the Gospels, you know, in the Psalms, we have some amazing verses that speak to what you're talking about, Jamie. Like Psalm 73:25 says, whom have I in heaven but you? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides you? My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. So literally, when he's saying my flesh and my heart may fail, like my body may give out, I might die, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. That's okay if I die because I have God. That's what he's saying. And, you know, there's other times where Jesus will confront people, and there's this phrase that shows up, and he says one thing. You know, it focuses the mind when you say, okay, this one thing to think about. And, you know, the rich man, for instance, when the rich man was given the offer to follow Jesus, Jesus said, sell all your things, give to the poor, and then come follow me. Well, basically, that man rejected Jesus's offer. But it says in Mark 10:21 that because this man has said he's kept all the commandments, he's lived a good enough life in his mind. But Jesus says to him, well, first it says Jesus looked at him and loved him. That's important to see. One thing you lack, he said, this is Jesus speaking, one thing you lack, go sell everything you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, then come follow me. And then when you look at the book of Luke, there's a very similar statement, very similar situation where Martha and Mary are hosting Jesus, and Mary is willing to sit at Jesus' feet and learn from him. But Martha is busy, and she gets all grumpy about that. She's the one serving food while Mary's sitting, you know, sitting down, enjoying herself, listening to the Lord. And basically Jesus rebukes Martha and says, look, Martha, Martha, you are concerned about so many things, but only one thing. Again, that phrase shows up. Only one thing is necessary, Martha. Mary has chosen the good portion, and it will not be taken away from her. And I can't help but think that some of these times that Jesus uses that language, it's meant to recall the psalm. Psalms continually speak about this, but Psalm 27:4 in particular says, one thing I ask from the Lord, this only do I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life. Gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to seek him in his temple. Your whole life, essentially, the Psalms are saying this, Jesus is saying this, everything can be boiled down to this. And that makes it very practical. Because again, practicality is not the test of truth. But the fact is, it will turn a Martha into a Mary. It will make you want to learn from the Lord, want to be in his presence, want to spend every moment with Jesus when you treasure him in this way. It will lead the rich young ruler to give up all that wealth, to sell everything he has and give to the poor. Because, why? Because Jesus is worth so much more than all the wealth that he has. And so it will spill out into loving others. It will transform your values. It will change the way you live your life when you treasure Jesus. And so never think of it as merely this theoretical idea to treasure Jesus above all else. It has tremendous implications for how we live our lives.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.